Thank you. Be seated.
This morning, the court has four causes on its oral submission docket. In the order of their presentation, they are as follows. Redmond Homes Incorporated versus Jimmy D. Ivey and Ida Irving Ivey from Gaines County. Lazaro Medina versus Jose Herrera and Interstate Forging Industries Incorporated from Grimes County. Kerrville State Hospital versus James O. and Genevieve Clark from Travis County. The National Association of Independent Insurers and Others versus the Texas Department of Insurance and Others from Travis County. The court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument, except in the third cause where we have allotted 25 minutes. Petitioner may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal. These arguments are being recorded for the court. If you would like to purchase a copy of the arguments, you may make application with our clerk. Court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Redmond versus Ivey.
May I please report? The speaker hearing will present argument to the petitioner. The petitioner has to give 5 minutes.
May I please report? Counsel. The judgment in this case should be reversed and judgment rendered for the defendant Redmond petitioner here because there is no evidence, legally insufficient evidence, to support the jury finding the damage issue, which is question number six. The plaintiff in this case sustained two types of damages, one to the mobile home itself and secondly to the personal property contents. Plaintiff chose to submit all those damages in one issue rather than submitting them in two issues. The jury found $79,000 in response to that issue. We have cited a case in our supplemental brief, Stewart Stevenson versus ServTech, 879 Southwest 2nd 89, which holds that where the plaintiff has more than one type of damage or there are more than one defendant, the plaintiff has the burden to submit separate damage issues. Here, as we've said, the plaintiff chose to submit all those damages in one issue. There was one other damage issue inquiring as to mental anguish, but that's not relevant here because the jury answered found none on that. The Court of Appeals found, and the plaintiff admits, that there was no evidence of probative weight with respect to the mobile home itself. The only testimony offered on the mobile home was the cost of the mobile home. The home was about 10 months old at the time of the damage, and the cases are cited in the court's opinion and other cases say that that is no evidence of probative weight as to the market value.
Mr. Kuhn, the court granted point of error on preemption, also on FRAP Rule 81. What do you have to say about preemption? What's the court granted on?
The points the court granted it on?
Yes, sir.
All right. The court court granted writs on point two and three. Point two is that the Court of Appeals erred in sending and remanding this case to the trial court solely on the issue of damages. The court found that there was insufficient evidence to support the damage issue. As we stated, we submit that there's none. But Rule 81B1 specifically talks about remanding in part, specifically says, provided that a separate trial on unliquidated damages alone shall not be ordered if liability issues are contested. Of course, there's no question here that liability issues were contested. Clearly, the damage issues were unliquidated, and there are numerous opinions, including one by Judge Baraja, who wrote the opinion in the court in the present case, stating that you cannot remand solely the issue of damages where damages are unliquidated and liability is contested.
If we assume for the sake of argument that that's true, where does that leave us with regards to preemption?
Well, if the court does not sustain our point that there's no evidence for damages, and since they weren't broken down, clearly there's no evidence, we submit that judgment should be reversed and rendered, because when there's no evidence that the defendant's entitled to rendition, if the court doesn't agree with that, then the entire case, liability, damages, and everything must be remanded to the trial court, because it's undisputed that the damages aren't supported.
We would only remand it to the trial court if we make a judgment that is not preempted. So I'm asking you, I'm trying to get you to argue about preemption.
All
how
right.
Does the TPA...
The preemption point is under the federal act, which is another ground for a rendition in addition to the damage issue. The statute itself specifically says that no state shall have authority to provide any standard which is not identical with the federal standard. In fact, the state has adopted the federal standards in 5221F, Section 4, and that's pointed out in a federal supplement case of Woolridge versus Redmond Holmes. In this case, therefore, the state statute and the federal statute on standards are the same.
If they're the same, we don't have a problem then. If the state statute and the federal statute do not conflict, there's no preemption problem.
Well, we submit there is a problem, because they tried to submit, they did submit breach of warranty and DTPA, but if the mobile home, we submit the undisputed evidence establishes that the mobile home complied with the federal standards, as which means it also complied with the state standards, then it cannot be a violation of DTPA or breach of implied warranty.
How is the DTPA and a breach of warranty claim construction or safety standards?
Well, if the home wasn't in violation of the state standards, then we submit there could be no breach of implied warranty or DTPA. The evidence is undisputed that each home was inspected, that this home specifically was inspected, met the requirements of the Act, and received a stamp or certificate which it had to receive before it could leave the factory and be sold.
What was the precise nature of the claim?
The precise nature of the claim was that the wiring in the home was defective, and the defective wiring caused...
A design defect or a manufacturing defect?
They're claiming that the wiring was defective when the home was manufacturing defect.
That it was designed badly? I mean, the way that they had wires too close to a heat source, that it was merely, there was a problem with this particular piece of wire that made it...
The pleadings weren't that specific. They didn't specifically allege design, so I presume they were claiming that this particular wire was defective.
What you're saying is if the federal government inspects, and if there's a stamp that a product has been inspected, then even if there's a latent defect in it, there can be no lawsuit. That's an end to it.
Well, if there was evidence of probative weight that in spite of that inspection, it didn't meet inspection, it was defective, possibly there could be, but that is another problem in this case, with the plaintiff's case. There was no evidence that the wiring was defective and that it didn't meet federal standards. There were several witnesses that testified specifically that it was not. The only evidence that they claim supports the contention that it was defective was a witness by the name of Lute, and he testified he didn't find any defect in the wiring, but he said he went through the other aspects and he couldn't find anything else that caused it, and therefore, in his opinion, the wiring must have caused it.
But
that
used to be on his recips a lot.
Isn't that some evidence, though?
We submit that it doesn't rise to a scintilla. It's really, in the context of his testimony, it's nothing more than speculation.
Why isn't that a res ipsa case? something that doesn't happen ordinarily in the absence of negligence, and every other cause has been negated.
Well, the home was in the possession of the plaintiffs, had been in the possession of, well, it had been in the possession of the dealer, and then it had been in possession and been lived in by the plaintiffs for 10 months before the fire happened. No res ipsa was not pled and was not submitted in any event.
It was alleged that Redmond breached an express warranty that the electrical system would be free from substantial defects for a period of 12 months. Why doesn't Mr. Lute's testimony along with that warranty support the judgment? Absent your concern about damages. Why doesn't that support the liability finding?
We submit that there is no legally sufficient testimony that the wiring was defective.
You can see that Mr. Lute did give an opinion to
that effect. He gave an opinion to the effect that, in his opinion, it was defective on the ground that he couldn't find any other cause.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, counsel. The court agreed to hear the petitioner's point of error number two, and I, on behalf of my clients, although reluctantly so, announced that I am at least in part in agreement with the petitioner that Rule 81, I think 1B, B1 of the Rules of Appellate Procedure would call for the remand of the entire case if there is a question of sufficiency of the evidence and unliquidated damages. As the petitioner has pointed out, the property damages were submitted conjunctively, that is, as to the market value of the building and that of the personalty. And the appellate court found that the evidence was insufficient to support a verdict on the entire property damages and remanded. I'm not keen on being quoted as finding fault with an appellate court ruling that was in my favor.
But, well, I appreciate your candor, but you're not saying the Paso Court of Appeals blew it.
Well, I'm trying to do that artfully.
So you're waiving your argument that this court has the authority to render it a lesser judgment.
The best that I can tell, even with our offer of remittiture, that the clearest move would be to remand the entire case because the damages are unliquidated. It seems to have been a sufficiency issue in El Paso, and the court did find sufficient evidence to support part of the property damages, that is the personalty. And I think the case law is pretty clear on that in Texas, that an owner can testify as to the market value of his or her own property if they indicate some experience or knowledge about the property value. And although Mr. Ivey might have made a little bit better witness than he did in that area, the appellate court noted and in fact quoted the testimony he gave, particularly when asked to tell us what he thought the property would sell for, what a reasonable person would pay to buy the items. Mr. Ivey testified that he understood that had been proceeded to testify item for item what he thought a reasonable purchaser would pay for those items.
Didn't he, on board Dyer, admit that he really didn't have any knowledge about the market?
Well, he, at one point he did indicate he was asked, I think I asked him, or maybe I think on board Dyer he was asked if he knew what these items would sell for, or a question sort of to that effect. And I think at one time he did answer, well, not really, but he...
Do you think he was rehabilitated from that, or is that a binding?
Well, I think so when asked directly the question, which is sort of a question of art, which is, do you understand that you're being asked if you have some knowledge of the value of these articles? He answered yes, and then he was asked, do you believe you have an idea of what a reasonable person would pay for them? And he answered yes. And then there is a long, I remember a tediously long session of question and answer where he went through item by item and spoke many times about, well, I think this was ring, or a person would pay this or that for this particular item. There were some of the items that I think fell under a kind of personal fee for which the doctrine of intrinsic worth might be appropriate. At any rate, it is a situation where the evidence supports a portion of the damages, and the appellate court has found that it does not support sufficiently another portion, and it may be I have difficulty arguing otherwise. It may be that the appropriate procedure or the following would be to remand the entire case. And
if that being the case, would you then speak to the other point we specifically granted on federal preemption?
Preemption? Yes. In fact, I'd like to spend the rest of my time doing that. It seems to be the position of the petitioner that the National Manufactured Housing Construction and Safety Regulations Act absolutely preempts any kind of state civil remedy for a homeowner. And this is despite the fact that there is no apparent conflict between the Texas consumer laws and that act. Their second position seems to be that where one of these homes is certified with a seal of approval applied by a state or some sort of government inspector, that establishes as a matter of law that the home is in compliance with the federal standards.
What evidence was there that there was a defect, and what kind of defect did you contend there was?
The evidence was that this particular home had failed inspection once, and it had failed where there were leaks found in the bathroom, and the one in the wash basin, and another in the bathing area.
What type of leaks?
They were leaks. I believe the one in the wash basin was at the drain.
What, of gas, water?
No, water. It was water leaks in both places. And eventually this unit was tagged as having passed inspection
by
a state inspector. Mr. Lute's testimony, the expert who testified on behalf of the plaintiff, testified that there was some likelihood that despite the fact that the unit had passed inspection ultimately, there was still a latent defect at one or both of these places, and that a leak still existed. He noted that the origin of the fire, his opinion was, is in the bathroom and under the floor at a place where it's undisputed there was circuitry. He testified that for a person who is educated and qualified to investigate and render opinions on fire origins, it's very often a process of elimination and deduction, and particularly where there is a fire as extensive as this one was, it's primarily a situation of ruling out. The fire, he said, originated under the floor in the bathroom at a place where there was circuitry. The circuitry was burned pretty much beyond a point where it could supply any information about its short. But where there was an indication that there had been a problem with this unit, that the problem was a leakage of water, it's common knowledge that water and circuitry are not a good combination, that there's some probability that this circuitry failed, either because it was exposed to moisture or for some other reason.
He said some probability. Did he go further than that?
He indicated that the only probative evidence at the site, and he was at the site, I think, within a few days of the fire, was that the fire originated at a point of circuitry, and that the only evidence was that it would have been a failure of the circuitry. There was just no evidence of anything else. I think the defendant's expert testified that there was he thought that an iron had fallen on the floor. But it became a conflict of experts, and the shorter case, which we cited, although it's not a Texas case, has an interesting footnote on page 338. This is 776 Federal Sup 333, where they indicated that certification is just a piece of evidence which may or may not support the defendant's position that the construction was in compliance. And where you have a battle of the experts, the fact that the house has been tagged does not establish conclusively that it's in compliance.
So do you say that it was or it was not in compliance?
We say that it was not. That it got through the wicket, that there was an undiscovered defect, there was a problem with the house that was not identified at the time that it was being inspected. And our position is that certification does not establish conclusively.
Is it your position that if it had been in compliance, if the damage would not have occurred?
No, because I think I don't think that's an issue that we need to reach, since there was expert testimony that there was a problem with the house and that it was a problem in an area which the manufacturers warranted would be safe.
Would there have to have been more done than the federal standards required?
No, not at all. I think we're in a situation where we're not, in our pleadings, and this is distinct from the case of McMillan, we're not pleading in any way that the federal standards are incomplete or that there is an area not covered by those standards that is pertinent to this case. We're just
saying home didn't meet it.
Home didn't meet it.
And if it had, might not burn down.
Might not have burned down, and that it is appropriate in a state cause, in a state case, a DTPA action or a consumer protection action, it's appropriate to suggest that there was a defect, despite the fact that it passed inspection. We're not finding fault with the the federal regulations at all. But I think that it's I don't think that the legislation, when enacted, was intended to mean that once the sticker's on the house, the position is the inspector is infallible.
You can see that there is a different preemption problem if your position is it met the federal standards, but that's not good enough, there's still liability, or it didn't meet the federal standards, and it should have, and therefore there should be liability for that.
Absolutely. That's where the McMillan case is interesting, because apparently the plaintiffs in that case made a decision at some point to allege a defect which the federal government had considered and rejected, or criteria to use in trying to protect the consumer from formaldehyde exposure. And the court there had decided that the measure would be of the emission from the materials used, the plywood and the particle board, rather than the level of formaldehyde in the atmosphere, because atmospheric changes, climate changes, made that, they believe, an unreliable measure. And apparently, in McMillan, the plaintiffs committed to that standard and stuck with it. And Woolridge, by distinction, is one where there is no complaint of a defect or a failure to reach a standard which is not identical with that promulgated by the federal statute and the federal agency.
So you're not trying to impose a different standard?
Absolutely not.
All right. We can move to preemption again. You familiar with American Airlines versus Woolens?
Somewhat, yes, sir.
How does this case distinguish from Woolens?
Well, you have a situation where there is no remedy provided by the federal regulation. And you have a situation where the pleadings are so...
In what instance am I following?
Well, I may not be able to provide a cogent argument for that.
Because it was, the Supreme Court seemed to say that a federal statute similar arguably similar to the DTPA was preempted. A state statute was preempted by federal resident.
State statute? Wasn't that a state statute that had something to do with
that? Federal statute preempted a DTPA type like remedy.
Did the federal statute have a provision for remedy of its own?
I don't recall.
I'm not sure about that, and I'd hate to pretend I know something I don't. There's the defendant cited English versus General Electric, which is a whistleblower type of case, and cited in that opinion is the famous Silkwood versus Kerr McGee opinion, and I had forgotten, but the Supreme Court there noted that there was no preemption, even where there was a state claim for damages, the result of a condition which the federal government had intended to preempt. And that may be the closest analog to what we have here. We have people who claim to be damaged by the quality of the construction of a home. That's certainly covered by the federal regulations. But there's no allegation that suggest that there should have been a standard met that was greater than or different from federal regulations.
Do the implied warranties, are they synonymous with safety standards?
Well, since the implied warranties are not specific to construction standards, and since the state of Texas has adopted identically the standards of the federal statute, I think read together, all that the Consumer Protection Act or the DTPA is suggesting is that where this item, this product does not, has a defect, which is inconsistent with the federal standards, then there could be a state action.
Are you suggesting that if the DTPA is inconsistent with the federal statute, that it would also have to necessarily be inconsistent with the Texas statute for Manufactured Housing Standards Act?
That it would have to be? No. And I hadn't thought of that. I hadn't really thought of this question in that way. I really had looked at this throughout as a situation where the Supreme Court seems to say repeatedly that where there is no conflict, that a state remedy is not inappropriate. If it's not in conflict or doesn't present a situation where a defendant cannot comply with both. And in the English case, there's even language that, one, that the federal regulatory scheme does not, should not cause one to presume that there's preemption. Where there is no apparent conflict between federal and state law, there certainly should be an effort to construe one.
On special issue number two, where the jury found there had been a false, misleading, or deceptive act, is there any evidence to support that finding other than breach of warranty?
Well, if the evidence is, if taking the evidence in the best light for the plaintiff, if the evidence is that there is a probability of some defect in the wiring, either circuitry or because of a combination of the circuitry and a leak in the floor, then the consumer is not getting the product that has been advertised to them. In both in the materials that accompany the product and in the advertising done by the seller, and that's the case that we have here. We have expert testimony that there's a defect. It's a probability the fire started as a result of this defect, burned the whole house down, and no real evidence to the contrary. And the house is advertised as being electrically sound and in compliance, no leaks.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
With respect to preemption, we agree that certainly there are types of cases in which would not be preempted, which could be brought, such as, for example, there was a claim made by the manufacturer that this house will last for 50 years or something like that, which would be outside the scope of the inspection standards of the federal statute, but there's not any pleading of anything like that. They're basically pleading that the mobile home was defective, and it didn't meet federal standards when it was manufactured, and we should submit the evidence reflects that it did.
Mr. Kuhn, do you concede that the Texas Manufactured Housing Standards Act expressly adopts the federal standards?
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor.
And so how could this cause of action be preempted unless this cause of action conflicted with the Texas standard, which is identical to the federal standard? In other words, logically, your argument would seem to be that there can be no DTPA cause of action because it violates, because it conflicts with this, with the Texas statute that adopts the federal standard.
In other words, where does the state statute conflict with the federal statute? Where's the conflict?
Well, I'm just saying that if there was a claim which came outside of either statute, it wouldn't be preempted. But I,
so there is no conflict?
There's no conflict between the state standards and the federal standards. And
because the state expressly adopts the federal standards. But I guess my question is, and perhaps Judge Gonzalez's is, you argue that this cause of action is preempted by the federal standard, but if the federal standard is the same
as
the state
standard. Well, we're really not arguing it's preempted by federal standards. Mm-hmm. We're arguing that the evidence establishes that it complied with federal standards and state standards, and there's no claim that it was some other type DTPA claim that would fall outside of those. So the evidence shows that there's no violation.
So rather than a preemption of rather than arguing that the state law is preempted by the federal law, you're saying that your product complied
with
both standards, and therefore there can be no liability?
With both state and federal law, and that this isn't, there are types of claims which we submit would not be preempted by either state or federal law, but this isn't one of them. There's no allegation that this is some, that they made some kind of representation, as I said, that the product will last 50 years or something, it wouldn't come under this.
Standards require that the manufacturer give a warranty. In other words, that the wiring be warranted for 1 year.
I can't answer that, John. I don't know that the standard, whether or not the standard specifically addressed wiring. I know that in this case there was an express warranty, which excluded other implied warranties.
Ms. Coon, this is a position inconsistent with the one you took in your brief. In your brief, you were arguing preemption. Point 3, I believe, in your brief, argues that the state law of claim is preempted by the Federal Manufactured Home Construction and Safety Standards Act. So are you waiving the preemption argument in your brief?
I may not have stated it fair, Your Honor, but I think if you'll read all the way under the whole thing, I think it's consistent with what I'm trying to say today, that it complies with the state statute and by virtue of the evidence that it complied with the state and federal statute, there's no basis for a claim.
The respondent argues that the federal act provides a standard but no remedy. Do you agree with that?
I'm not that familiar with the state statute. As far as I know, it provides no remedy.
I understand your point 3. You're relying on the Federal Safety Act in mobile home construction. And his response is it doesn't provide a remedy. Do you agree with that argument?
I assume that it does not need the state or the federal act to provide a remedy.
Well, then my next question is, if it doesn't provide a remedy, what is your claim if there's a violation of the federal standards under the act? And the next question is, if there's none, why can't you use a state statute or common law remedy to satisfy a breach of the federal standard, too, since they're both the same?
Well, I assume that the federal remedy would apply if there's no statute.
Well, no. first question was, do you agree or disagree whether there's no remedy provided by the federal act?
I'm not that familiar with the federal act.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes argument in the first call. The court will take a brief recess.